Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. I discuss sexual assault in today's episode, though not in graphic detail, but it may be distressing to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Most people believe there is no greater tragedy than the loss of a child. It is the deepest grief, unending. Your life changes on a molecular level. Every day may start with a brief moment of forgetting, but your torment is back before you've barely opened your eyes. It doesn't matter how old that child was. The loss is irreparable. To lose a child by violence has to be the most cruel loss of all. And what if your child goes missing? You may desperately hold on to hope, or you may be awash in despair. You don't just wake with grief, you go to sleep with it. You cradle the unknowing emptiness in your dreams. Shannon Melindy was 19 years old when she vanished. Technically an adult, but really still a girl. A girl with her whole life ahead of her. A girl who dreamed big. What she did not dream of was a danger right in front of her. She wasn't walking in a dark alley, nervous and watchful of her surroundings. She walked off on her lunch break, in the middle of the day, in front of coworkers and hundreds of other people, and was never seen again. Welcome to episode 137, The Disappearance and Murder of Shannon Melindy. The day Shannon Melindy disappeared was March 22, 1994, and it was a warm day in Atlanta, Georgia. Temperatures reached 71 degrees Fahrenheit, a little over 21 degrees Celsius. Warm days like this in southern states can be a nice respite, the first sign of spring, or a warning sign. We just had a terrible reminder of what strange warm weather can do. At this recording, at least 80 people were killed in the deadliest December tornado storms in U.S. history, most in my neighboring state of Kentucky. I had already written this opening before the storms hit, and I wrote in this part today with tears in my eyes. Words just aren't enough in a tragedy of this magnitude. My heart is so heavy. The day after Shannon vanished, March 27, 1994, was Palm Sunday, and a tornado outbreak killed 18 people in Floyd County, about an hour and a half away from Atlanta. But on Saturday, Shannon Melindy was enjoying the perfect warm day to be at work. She worked at a softball field. Ace of Base was dominating the radio with their number one hit single, The Sign. I am Shannon's age, or the age she should be. She was born 6 days before me. My friends and I loved grunge and classic rock, though I harbored a love for pop songs and soon got them all addicted to The Sign. It was such an earworm, and the video played on repeat on MTV. It spent 6 weeks at number one in the U.S. In 2012, The Sign would come back into my life when the movie Pitch Perfect was released. My stepchildren were obsessed with that movie, and we listened to the soundtrack everywhere we went. I especially loved belting out Pitch Perfect's version of The Sign with them in the car with me. Shannon Melindy never got that chance, not for stepchildren, or children of her own, or a spouse. Instead, her family lost her. Lost the nieces or nephews who could have been. The grandchildren her parents would never cradle. She left a huge hole in their hearts, and they still fight for her to this day. It is always jarring to cover a case when the victim is my age. They are frozen in time, and I only think of them as the teenager they were when I'm in the early stages of writing. And then it hits me. Shannon had just gotten back from spring break at Daytona Beach in Pensacola. She had gotten a nice tan that she gushed about to her mom on the phone. Shannon had arranged with her boss to work on March 26th instead of the next day. She worked at the Softball Country Club of Atlanta, sometimes in the gift shop and sometimes as a scorekeeper. She had wanted to play in a soccer game on the 27th, so on March 26th, she was at the club with her score pad. She got a break at 12:45 and went to grab lunch so she could make it back for the 1:15 game. But she didn't come back from break. It wasn't like Shannon. She was responsible. But they replaced her as scorekeeper and the games continued. This was in the time of cell phones, but personal phones were definitely not the necessity they are now. I didn't have one in college. Neither did Shannon. But no one was really alarmed until she didn't come back to her dorm that night at Emory University. Her roommate, Athena Perez, was pretty worried. It wasn't like Shannon. By the next morning, Athena was really panicking. She gathered some friends, and they went looking for Shannon, starting with the softball club, which was around 5 minutes from campus. On their way to the club, they actually missed the entrance, and when they turned around, they saw Shannon's car, a black Nissan. It was at the Citgo gas station next to the club. It was parked crookedly at the far end of the gas station, unlocked, and the keys were in the ignition. Athena called the police and said Shannon had been missing for 24 hours. She said a female police officer came to the scene, looked around, and jotted down everyone's information, and then told them they could drive the car back to campus. Athena was shocked that the police didn't take the car to process it for evidence. She said the officer was very laid back about it. The officer did speak to an employee working at the gas station where Shannon's friends had found her car. The employee confirmed Shannon was there that Saturday. But that was it. The officer didn't investigate further or call in backup. As the hours passed, Athena knew she had to call Shannon's parents, a call she was dreading. Luis and Yvonne Melendi lived in Miami, and they caught the next flight to Atlanta after Athena's call. Luis later said when he got the call, his knees buckled, and he said, "It's Shannon. We'll never see her again." He said he had an eerie feeling and just knew. Yvonne fell to her knees in prayer. Shannon's parents also reported their daughter missing to the police, who this time did initially seem to take her disappearance seriously. Now around 50 or 60 officers searched a radius of several square miles around the club. Creek beds and abandoned houses, buildings, and apartments were searched, but nothing was found. Officers said they found no evidence of foul play. So they told Shannon's parents that she'd probably run off to Cancun on a whim. One officer said, "She'll turn up." Athena would later say that police didn't just believe it was a whim, but that Shannon was a runaway. They focused on questioning her friends, including Athena, who was interrogated for 8 hours. She said the officer told her, quote, "Shannon ran away. You guys know where she is. You know you're hiding her." Athena Perez was in disbelief. And really, it's not like this was the 1960s or 70s when teenagers still hitchhiked with carefree abandon. Shannon Melendi had just grown up in the decade of stranger danger. She was not a runaway. It was absurd the police ever focused on this as a possibility. Shannon was a responsible young woman, an overachiever, and an excellent student. She would not even have run off an hour away and not tell her roommate. She would have called Athena by now. It is especially painful for family and friends when the police are dismissive like this. They know in their bones that their loved one didn't just leave without telling anyone, vanishing without a trace. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Shannon Denise Melendi was born on October 20th, 1974, in Miami, Florida, to parents Yvonne and Luis. She was a lovely brunette who favored her photogenic mother. In 1961, Luis and his parents had fled communist Cuba. In 1970, he met Yvonne and they married. Shannon was their first child. 5 years later, they had another daughter, Monique, and raised their girls in Miami. Luis opened his own portrait studio and became an award-winning photographer, and Yvonne worked at a Miami bank. The successful couple were well-respected within Miami's Cuban community, and their daughter followed in their hard-working footsteps. Shannon was president of her junior and senior classes at Southwest Miami Senior High School. She played soccer, was a Legal Eagle, and actually spoke before Congress and the UN while still in high school. In 1992, Shannon was nominated for a Silver Knight Award in the speech category. It's an award for students who use their talents to serve their communities and peers in school. It's a great honor to be nominated by your school for this award. Shannon's high school political science teacher and soccer coach, Angel Menendez, later said, quote, "In a way, Shannon's high school years were a preview of what was to come in her adult life, standing in Congress as a student representative, addressing the student delegates in the General Assembly Hall of the United Nations, or arguing her case as a student attorney at the Dade County Mock Trials Competition. All were unique previews of what life lay in store for her." Shannon graduated cum laude in the National Honor Society and then accepted a scholarship to Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. She had been accepted at Georgetown and American universities, but Emory offered her a $15,000 per year scholarship for all 4 years in college. As her political science teacher explained, Shannon's goals were extremely impressive. She majored in Spanish and political science at Emory and planned to attend law school and join the Navy. She wanted to become a JAG Corps attorney, and her ultimate dream was to serve as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. During her freshman year, Shannon became the first ever freshman to win a paid internship with former President Jimmy Carter's nonprofit organization, Carter Center, in Atlanta. Shannon worked 15 hours a week doing clerical work in the conference and events department. Shannon's family and friends describe how special she was in such beautiful ways. Her mother, Yvonne, said, quote, "She tried to show people that there are not just weeds on the side of the road, that there are flowers that grow in between, and they are really pretty." Her close friend Jennifer described Shannon as a very happy, energetic person who was very good-hearted and wanted to make the world a better place. And her heartbroken 14-year-old sister said, quote, "She was my idol, my role model, my confidant, someone I looked up to, my friend. The day Shannon walked away from that softball field, someone had been watching her. And if the police had bothered to question her coworkers, they might have found him sooner. As it was, they dismissed the Melendi family's concerns, insisting Shannon would turn up soon on her own. So now the Melendis were on their own." Without the help of police, Shannon's friends and family collected $10,000 for a reward, and they also put up 60 billboards and 10,000 posters. The Melendis began using the press. Yvonne publicly pleaded for her daughter's return. She said the only way Shannon could be missing was if she was abducted. She was not a person to leave on a whim. Shannon's dad, Luis, said, "This is not a disappearing act. Shannon's car was found with the keys in it. This is totally out of character." Luis reached out through friends to Cuban-born actor Andy Garcia and pro football and baseball player Bo Jackson. Both recorded PSAs asking for the public's help in finding Shannon. President Jimmy Carter and his wife Rosalind also released a statement offering prayers and asking anyone with information to come forward. On March 29th, a man called the phone number on the missing posters and said he kidnapped the missing girl at the gas station and was going to keep her until he was through with her. Then on April 6th, a man called a student hotline at the Emory University Counseling Center and said, "I know you can trace this line. I have Shannon. She's okay. She's lonely. To prove I have Shannon, I'm going to tape her ring to the back of the phone." Using caller ID, police were able to track down where the man called from. They went to a payphone in a small town called Rex in Georgia. The payphone was near a Waffle House, and they found a ring in a small cloth bag wrapped in masking tape. It was a blue topaz ring that had been a gift from Shannon's godmother. The bag was traced to a manufacturer who said the only customer they have in Georgia was Delta Airlines. The masking tape was also used by Delta. Police found particles of metal on the tape. They were a combination of metal debris found only in environments involving jet engine maintenance and repair. About 2 weeks later, Shannon's parents told the press about the ring. They'd initially been told not to say anything. Luis told the media, "The FBI said it was good news that he was letting us know she was alive and was okay." But later, Yvonne said, "We got really excited because we thought we would get another phone call. We were optimistic that she was alive, but it's been more than 2 weeks and no call. We are desperate. The South Florida Congressional Delegation and Senators Bob Graham and Connie Mack wrote a letter to U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno. An FBI task force was set up, and they worked with DeKalb County in Atlanta. This is when the real investigation started. The missing posters and billboards were replaced with kidnapped ones. Yvonne told the media, quote, "Now we got approval to put kidnapped on the posters. It's very important to us, the word kidnap. My daughter is not missing. She's been abducted, and I need help if anyone remembers seeing her." Shannon's case was featured on The Oprah Winfrey Show, America's Most Wanted, and many other shows locally and nationally. Because police had waited so long to take Shannon's disappearance seriously, many pieces of evidence were already gone. Security tapes had already been erased. Shannon's car had been released to her roommate, Athena, before it could be searched for evidence. The FBI agent who unraveled the ring from the bag didn't wear gloves. Calls made to the counseling center at Emory were not recorded. And the weekend after Shannon's disappearance was Easter weekend, so the police didn't interview anyone that weekend, letting even more time lapse. It was one embarrassing mistake after another. Also, police had focused their attention on the 1,000 people at the stadium that day instead of looking at employee records. If they had, they might have seen that one of the employees working the same day as Shannon's disappearance was a convicted sex offender. When they finally spoke to Shannon's coworkers, police found that several players actually complained that the umpire working the March 26th game wasn't doing his job. Instead, he kept looking at and talking to the scorekeeper. One player said, "I would throw a pitch, and then mid-stride he would turn around and look at the scorekeeper. It was like he was obsessed with her. He went to her between innings. He went to her while I was pitching. He was more interested in her than he was in the ball game." That umpire was Butch Hinton. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. Hey y'all, if you ever wanted to make your home feel safer, there's no better time than now. This week, our friends at Simply Safe are giving Southern Fried listeners early access to all their holiday deals, 40% off their award-winning home security. We love Simply Safe because it has everything you need to make your home safe. Indoor and outdoor cameras, comprehensive sensors, all monitored around the clock by trained professionals who send help the instant you need it. The sensors are amazing. We live in a home built in the 1930s, so it's really nice to customize the sensors because of our unusual spaces. The wireless outdoor camera is also perfect for our home with its built-in floodlight. We pointed the camera at our cars, which are outside the normal sight line. Simply Safe was even named Best Home Security System of 2021 by U.S. News & World Report. We customize our system online in minutes. It was super easy. And you can get free custom recommendations from Simply Safe. These are Simply Safe's biggest discounts of the year. You can get a complete home security system starting at just over $100. You should really jump on this opportunity now. There are no long-term contracts or commitments. It's a really easy way to feel a bit more peace of mind. Take advantage of Simply Safe's holiday deals and get 40% off your new home security system by visiting simplysafe.com/southernfried. Again, that's simplysafe.com/southernfried for 40% off your entire system. Today's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. What interferes with your happiness or prevents you from achieving your goals? For me, it's anxiety and depression. Medication helps, but for me, talking to someone who is objective about my problems can be really helpful and cathartic. BetterHelp is there for me, and they will be there for you too, with licensed professionals who specialize in all kinds of issues like trauma, grief, depression, anxiety, and family or relationship conflicts, the kind of things that we all face every day. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own specialized therapist. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can start communicating with your counselor in under 48 hours. You can send a message to your BetterHelp counselor at any time, and everything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/southern. Now police had a lead and looked into Butch Hinton and his movements that day. They found out he was scheduled to work a full day on March 26th, but on the day before, he had learned that his wife was going to be out of town, so he made other arrangements. He called his wife's best friend and asked her to meet on the afternoon of the 26th. He said it was important that she not tell anyone where she was going or who she was meeting. Hinton said his wife would be with him. Then he called another umpire and asked him to cover the second half of his shift. He said he had a hot date. The umpire wasn't available to work, so Hinton called his supervisor and said he needed to take the second half off to take care of some family problems. His request was granted because Hinton left work at around 12:45 p.m. A few minutes later, Shannon left in the same direction. But then at 1:54 p.m., Hinton called his supervisor and said he could work more games that day, but his boss said he wasn't needed. He also made calls to his wife and other family and friends. He was probably hoping to establish an alibi. Between 2:30 and 3 p.m., Butch Hinton was seen walking from the Sitgo gas station back to the softball club. That would be the gas station where Shannon's car was found. Back at the club, Hinton told a coworker that he was getting ready for a game, but he wasn't dressed in his umpire uniform. He was wearing baggy, tiger-striped workout pants. Then shortly after, the same coworker saw Hinton headed for the clubhouse. At around 5 p.m., another coworker saw Hinton and said, "I thought you left." Hinton then said he came back because he had forgotten to turn in his pay slip, but there was no pay slip in his hand. Then, at around 3 a.m. the next morning, Hinton was seen tending a very large fire in his yard by a neighbor. And then at 7 a.m., he borrowed a bone saw from his father. Colvin Cornelius Butch Hinton III was born in Kentucky in September of 1960, and his violent history began when he was still a teenager. In 1977, when Butch was 17, he and his younger brother went over to his boss's house. He worked in a pizza parlor. He knew his boss was at work and his wife was home alone. He raped his boss's wife and then ordered his brother to tie her up. The woman promised she wouldn't call the police and talked Hinton into letting her go. The brothers untied her and left, and then she immediately called the police. But Butch Hinton was a minor, so he was only sentenced to get counseling. I find this kind of astonishing. He was 1 year away from adulthood at 17. He easily could have been tried as an adult, or at the very least, been sent to juvie for a year along with long-term counseling. Following this incident, Butch's family left Kentucky and moved to Illinois. At some point, he married a woman named Gail. While living in Illinois, Hinton worked as a butcher. In 1982, just 5 years later, at the age of 22, Hinton was living in Illinois when he lured his younger brother's former girlfriend to a cemetery, saying that his brother would meet her there. When 14-year-old Tammy Singleton showed up, Hinton put a knife to her throat, tied her up, and took her back to his home and held her in his basement. He raped the young girl. When his wife came home, she heard screams and found Tammy in the basement. Gail and Butch untied Tammy and took her to their pastor. In September of 1982, Hinton pled guilty but mentally ill to charges of kidnapping and indecent liberties with a minor. He was sentenced to just 4 years in prison, but he only served 2 years and then was released on parole in June 1984. 4 years for raping a 14-year-old girl, and then he was let out after 2 years. Gail divorced him after this, and he remarried a woman named Michelle after he moved to Georgia. He was only on supervised parole for 2 years after he was released. Steve Daniels, an investigative reporter for NBC6, heavily investigated Hinton's past and put together a criminal history. In his search, he found an additional victim, a member of his extended family who said Hinton had abducted and repeatedly assaulted her. According to Daniels, the assault on the family member was swept under the rug. By March of 1994, when Shannon disappeared, Butch Hinton lived in Rex, Georgia with his wife and was working at Delta Airlines as a maintenance utility employee. He also worked part-time as an umpire at the Softball Country Club in Atlanta. He attended church regularly. And he was a violent sexual predator. He lived in the small town where Shannon's ring was found. He worked with her. Finally zeroing in on Hinton, police searched his home and car on April 12th. That is 18 days Butch Hinton had to destroy evidence. Although they did not find any evidence of Shannon Melindy, they did find several items of women's clothing buried in his backyard. There were sweaters, skirts, and blouses, all in varying sizes, but none of them belonged to his wife. To this day, police don't know anything about these clothes or the women who wore them. They also found plastic pants like those worn at crime scenes and wire ties that could be used to bind wrists and ankles. Also, 9 rolls of masking tape, matching the kind wrapped around the ring, were found at Hinton's house. In his car, police found metal particles that would later be found to match the particles on the tape and the bag with the ring. After searching his house for 4 hours, authorities told the media but said they didn't find anything and refused to say exactly what they were looking for. They also said that Butch Hinton was not a suspect. Investigators would search his house 6 more times. But Hinton knew he was their main suspect and asked another Delta employee to get him a pass card ticket. Those kind of tickets could only be used if the employee was wearing a suit. Butch didn't own a suit, so he asked another employee if he could borrow one. I swear, for someone smart enough to hide Shannon Melindy's body, he sure incriminated himself a lot with co-workers. But it didn't matter, because that same night, the media publicly reported that Hinton was possibly a suspect. He didn't fly anywhere and did not return to Delta. Although named as a suspect in Shannon's disappearance, Butch Hinton was teaching Sunday school at his church just a few months later. He had either been fired or quit the Softball Country Club, as well as Delta, and began managing a McDonald's in College Park. While there, on January 27, 1995, Butch Hinton was arrested for the false imprisonment of a 19-year-old young woman named Della, another 19-year-old. In December 1994, at around 8 p.m., Della was walking home after her shift at McDonald's. She said Hinton grabbed her very hard by the arm as she was leaving. Then he threatened her by saying, "I've taken care of a woman before and wouldn't mind doing it again." Then headlights appeared and scared Hinton, who let her go and just casually walked away, she said. Following his arrest, Hinton was released on a $5,000 bond. But the charges were dismissed in February 1995 after Della didn't appear at the preliminary hearing. During this time, DeKalb County prosecutors had gone before a grand jury to indict Hinton for Shannon's murder. However, the grand jury did not think there was enough evidence. The lead prosecutor, John Petrie, later said Hinton's background, his previous arrests, his history as being a sexual predator had come to light. But there was no body, no crime scene, no eyewitnesses who could really put them together. They had been on the same softball field that day, but that was it. By June of 1994, Louise Melindy had told the media that the FBI was no longer actively looking for Shannon. The implication was clear. It had been 3 months. They thought she was dead. As Louise said, all signs pointed to Butch Hinton, but there was no arrest. A DeKalb County police spokesman said they had gone from 12 full-time investigators to 1. He said leads were now at a trickle and they didn't think they were any closer to solving the case. He said, "We need a break." Louise went to the media again in July, saying that a captain in the DeKalb County Police Department had called him late at night, close to midnight, and gave him a gruesome theory on what he believed happened to Shannon. Louise said Yvonne woke up and overheard the call and became hysterical. Louise angrily told the media this call was insensitive and disrespectful. Captain Rodney Maddox confirmed he called Louise, clarifying that he was returning Louise's call, though why that late at night is beyond me. He refused to confirm what he told Louise, but complained that he told the grieving father to keep their conversations confidential. Quote, I wish Luis would help us preserve the security of the investigation. Out of desperation, he's trying any way he can to attract media attention. Maddox said he tried to keep Luis apprised of the investigation, but quote, as time goes by, it's less likely that she's going to be alive. I think that's a very realistic statement, even if it's a difficult pill to swallow. Then he said, in many cases, there's no one there to blame, except the investigating authorities. Luis Melendi was right. This was disrespectful. Maddox's comments to the press were equally as hurtful as the phone call. On September 8, 1994, Butch's house caught on fire, causing damage to the rear of his home. Smoke and water damaged the home throughout. He filed an insurance claim, but the police obviously believed he set the fire himself, hoping to hide any other evidence. In late September of 1994, Luis, the FBI, and DeKalb police all stated that authorities believed Shannon was dead. However, investigators would not comment on Hinton as a suspect, or if they believed the fire at his house was related to Shannon's disappearance. In June 1995, a federal grand jury indicted Butch Hinton for arson. The prosecution said Hinton poured gasoline throughout his house, set it on fire, and collected $185,000 by saying a faulty vacuum started the fire. After the indictment came back, a Georgia U.S. attorney told the press, quote, this indictment is a separate indictment not directly connected to Miss Melendi's disappearance. But the insurance company released a statement saying they believed Shannon's disappearance was the motive for the fire. The trial was actually moved to Panama City to avoid all the publicity in the Atlanta area in regards to Shannon's case. In January 1996, Hinton was convicted of mail fraud and using a fire to commit a felony. He was sentenced to a maximum of 10 years in prison. In December of 2003, 7 years later, Butch Hinton was released from federal prison. Investigators again started trying to pin him down for Shannon's murder. The lead prosecutor, John Petrie, looked at the case file and said, quote, the more I looked at it, the more I was absolutely convinced Butch Hinton was guilty. Petrie then called Luis to tell him he wanted to bring charges against Hinton. Petrie later recalled this conversation. After he told Luis that he was going to open a case against Hinton, Luis said, I've been waiting for 10 years for this phone call. By using electron microscopes, investigators definitively tied Hinton to the tape and the bag the ring was in. Specks of metal from the Delta Airlines facility where he worked were matched to the ones found on the tape and bag. The pieces of metal were also found in his car. Petrie later explained the process, quote, we hired an aeronautical scientist who was familiar with what metals and what chemicals are used in aircraft manufacture or repair. Basically, there were combinations of metal fragments on this tape of tungsten cobalt in such quantities and mixtures that he said this tape came from an aircraft manufacturer or an aircraft repair place. That's exactly what Hinton's job was at Delta Airlines in Atlanta. Investigators gathered other evidence too, like the incriminating statements he'd made to a multitude of other prisoners. A prisoner named Adonis said he woke up to the sound of Butch Hinton screaming. Adonis found him crying. He said he didn't kill her. The demon inside him had. He said the girl worked at a softball park and her car was found with the keys in it. Another man named Curtis said that he mentioned to Hinton that he knew someone who was charged with murder, even though no body was found. Hinton asked Curtis to show him how to research no body cases in the law library. Later, Hinton asked Curtis to sign an affidavit that they hadn't discussed his case. A man named Allen said Hinton was worried he'd be indicted for Shannon's death because his scorebook was left in her car and he had previous offenses. He said he had been burning a lot of brush in the middle of the night on the 26th. That's what his neighbors had seen. Hinton added that he would be curious to know what was left after a body was burned. A prisoner named Johnny said when he told Hinton that gambling was his weakness, Hinton said his was young girls. He told Johnny he was a suspect in the disappearance of a girl who worked with him. He said the girl reminded him of a woman he had an affair with in Kentucky years earlier. Hinton said police suspected him because they were aware of the Kentucky affair. He said he wasn't worried about police finding the body and that he could, quote, be forgiven no matter what he had done. A man named Ronson, said Hinton told him, he and Shannon left the club in her car, which was later found at the gas station. He said the police were stupid to have released the car without searching it. Yeah, no shit. Hinton also told Ronson that Shannon was a tease, and her body had been scattered to the wind, and that the best way to get rid of a body was to cut it up, crush the bones, and throw the pieces in a river. Hinton also said he was a butcher, bragging that he could cut up a cow in 30 minutes to an hour without getting blood on him. And finally, he said that God forgives murder. Okay, I've talked about jailhouse snitches before. They are not always reliable. They sometimes have ulterior motives. But the sheer number of prisoners who Hinton talked to is compelling. They collectively tell a story. On August 30th, 2004, Butch Hinton was finally indicted with malice murder and felony murder. Malice murder is similar to first-degree murder in other states, and Hinton was charged with felony murder because of the kidnapping, even though he couldn't actually be charged with kidnapping because the statute of limitations had passed. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. Southern Fried listeners know I play Best Fiends all the time, year-round. But it's also really fun to play during the hectic holidays when I need a little pick-me-up. Best Fiends has it all, an amazing storyline, collectible fiends, and tons of fun puzzles. It's way more fun than other Match 3-style puzzle games. I swear, 30 minutes go by like 30 seconds. And no Wi-Fi? No problem. Play Best Fiends wherever and whenever you want with offline mode. I woke up this morning and my power was out. It came back quickly, but my Wi-Fi took forever to reset afterwards, so I played Best Fiends while I waited. So even if your holiday travels take you off the beaten path, you can still play Best Fiends. I've been playing for almost 2 years, ever since Best Fiends became one of my most supportive sponsors. I've made it to level 2342, but I've still got literally thousands of levels to play, with more added all the time. Best Fiends is an action-packed adventure and a brain-boosting puzzle game all rolled into one. And with new content added all the time, you're never bored. Download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Today's episode is also brought to you by Olive in June, the amazing at-home nail salon. I love having a great manicure, and I like to try out new colors all the time, but I don't always have time to go to the nail salon, and I like to do my own nails while I'm relaxing, watching TV. But they've never looked salon quality until now. I got the Olive in June Studio Box, which comes with everything you need, including this cool accessory called the Poppy. You attach it to a brush to stabilize your hand. So now, my right hand doesn't look like a five-year-old painting. The Olive and June Studio Box came with 13 different colors to try, all of which are hot shades right now, from nude to a deep midnight blue. And the polish is so durable. It does not chip and it lasts for about a week and sometimes longer. I suggest starting with the Olive and June Mani system with 6 polishes. It breaks down to just $2 a mani, and I used to spend over $40 for one gel mani. Getting beautiful salon perfect nails at home is now a dream come true with Olive and June. Your new nail life is here. Visit oliveandjune.com/southernfried and use code southernfried for 20% off your first mani system. This is an exclusive offer you can only get here. That's oliveandjune.com/southernfried, code southernfried for 20% off your first mani system. oliveandjune.com/southernfried, code southernfried. Throughout this whole process, Shannon's dad, Luis, was pretty outspoken about his distaste for the DeKalb County Police Department's treatment of the case. After Hinton was finally arrested, Luis said, "I'm not blaming Atlanta for this. I'm not blaming Emory for this. It could happen to anyone, anywhere. And what the Melendi family is trying to do is raise awareness and say it could happen to you." Yvonne said, "People tend to think something like this only happens to other people. This would never happen to me." Luis has also said, if the judge had sentenced Butch Hinton to 4 years in prison when he kidnapped 14-year-old Tammy Singleton, had given him 15 or 20 years instead, Shannon would be alive today. We are supposed to trust our lawmakers and judges, but some of them are not doing their jobs, period. He's right. Hinton only served 2 years for kidnapping and sexually assaulting a 14-year-old girl. Even if his juvenile record about his first rape was sealed, his second offense, the violent assault on a young girl, should have been taken much more seriously. That sentence was bullshit. Letting him out after 2 years was bullshit. I'm sorry, but this whole case has been bullshit. But miraculously, prosecutors prevailed in court. On August 22, 2005, Butch Hinton's trial for the murder of Shannon Melendi began. The prosecution did not seek the death penalty because Shannon's body was never found. They said Shannon had not disappeared on her own and introduced correspondence between Shannon and her friends and family, which showed that she had strong ties to them and would make her voluntary disappearance unlikely. They also brought up how in March 1994, Shannon went on spring break at Daytona Beach in Pensacola. When she got home, she called her mom and told her about the great tan she'd gotten. This wasn't the conversation of a girl planning to run away. I know why they felt they had to give this argument, because of what the defense would later argue. But the biggest glaring factor here is that Shannon Melendi never came back. She wasn't the kind of girl who would run away in the first place, but she certainly would have contacted her family in the last decade after this massive search. She was dead. The prosecution admitted that they didn't have a lot of physical evidence, but they had Hinton's confessions to other prisoners, as well as the metal fragment on the tape evidence. Prosecutors said because Hinton's wife was out of town, he tried to make plans with another woman, but those plans fell through, so he focused on Shannon. And Hinton and Shannon were seen leaving the club at around the same time, but she was never seen again. Shannon's car was at the gas station, and a witness saw Hinton walking from the area of the gas station towards the club. He made several calls and then went back to the club to establish an alibi. The next day, a neighbor saw a big bonfire in Hinton's backyard. When police searched his property, they found fire pits in the yard, and one of them was a pair of plastic handcuffs. There were also wire ties that could be used to bind someone. The bag the ring was found in matched to those used at Delta, where Butch worked. Metal fragments on the tape matched unusual alloys used at Delta to repair airplane engines. The prosecution also introduced evidence concerning Hinton's prior criminal history. The defense objected to this evidence, saying the cases were too dissimilar to what the state was saying happened to Shannon. Thankfully, the judge ruled that the cases showed, quote, a pattern of tricking women into vulnerable situations, then restraining them for the purpose of sexual assault. Both cases showed his, quote, plan and scheme, motive, intent, and frame of mind. The first woman Butch Hinton raped testified, the wife of his former employer, but she did not want to disclose her identity. Tammy Singleton, the 14-year-old girl Hinton raped in 1982, did testify at trial, and she has been public with her experience, or I would not have named her. Tammy said Hinton had a Jekyll and Hyde element in his personality. The night he abducted her, at first he was nice, then he would show violent rage, and then contrition. She said, quote, I saw what I would describe as the presence of evil in his eyes. Tammy said Hinton bound her with some type of wires in addition to tape and rope. Gail, his ex-wife, testified that when she freed Tammy, Hinton looked to be near catatonic. Hinton's defense said the prosecution had zero evidence tying him to Shannon's disappearance or her murder. They said, Mr. Hinton did some terrible things in the past. You're not going to like Butch Hinton. But it would be a huge jump to convict him of murder when there was no body or blood or any other sign of violence at his house. They theorized that Shannon either ran away because of stress in her life or she was the victim of foul play by another person. And the reason she became a victim was due to drug and alcohol abuse and promiscuity. They wanted to take this theory further, but the judge put a stop to any further evidentiary exploration of her character and lifestyle. But not before the defense asked Shannon's close friend Jennifer if she had ever smoked weed. Jennifer said yes, like 90% of other college students. The defense asked other classmates about Shannon getting in trouble for cheating in one class at Emory. They also asked about Shannon being stressed because she'd overspent her budget and her parents had trouble paying for college. But Shannon's friends said she was coping well and was outgoing and friendly. She wasn't stressed enough to run away. Shannon Melendi was not a drug addict or an alcoholic. She was just a normal college student. The defense's case was victim blaming at its finest, but I suppose that was the only straw they had to grasp. The defense said that the inmates who testified to things Hinton told them in prison were lying to get a better sentence. The prosecution flatly denied making any deals with prisoners. In closing arguments, the prosecution said, quote, "Make sure the days of blaming inner demons are over. Butch Hinton is the demon." On September 19, 2005, after the jury deliberated for 9 hours over 3 days, Butch Hinton was found guilty on both counts of malice murder and felony murder. He was emotionless when he heard the verdict. He was sentenced to life in prison for both charges, but they were merged due to sentencing laws. On the stand, Yvonne spoke to Butch, quote, "This is the first and last time I will ever speak to you. You murdered Shannon, but you did not kill her spirit. She will live in our memories forever." Yvonne told the media, "I want him to spend a very long, miserable life in prison. That's where he belongs." It was the first no-body murder conviction in Georgia. But there were other issues with the sentencing laws. The prosecution tried to get life without parole, but it wasn't legal at the time. The law didn't change until the next year, so any violent felon who committed their crime prior to July 1, 2006 are automatically considered for parole after serving 14 years, but they can't apply after 7 years. The Melendys were not aware of this and felt blindsided. Every time I read something like this in the research, I wanted to scream. Why weren't they warned? Hinton appealed his conviction and sentence on multiple grounds. But on July 12, 2006, the Supreme Court of Georgia denied Hinton's appeal. Following the denial, Hinton confessed to his father what he did to Shannon. Then he asked his attorney to tell DeKalb authorities he wanted to talk to them. ABC News was also invited to attend. On July 17, 2006, the Supreme Court of Georgia said they would not reconsider the appeal. That same day, Butch Hinton confessed to what he did to Shannon. He spoke to the prosecutor and the lead detective on camera. He said, "I can't live like this no more. If I have to stay in a cell for 23 hours a day for the rest of my life, at least I can breathe. She can't. The prison that I am in is no comparison to the prison inside of me." Hinton was not given any sort of deal in exchange for the confession. He said he had planned to rape another woman on March 26th, but she refused to meet up with him. After meeting Shannon for the first time at the game, he invited her to lunch, and she accepted. They ate at a local Burger King, and as they were driving his car back to the club, Hinton faked a wrong turn. He pulled onto a highway and headed for his place in Rex, Georgia. Then he faked a leg cramp and asked Shannon to drive. She agreed, and Hinton climbed into the back seat. He took out a knife he'd hidden in the floorboard, and then held it to Shannon and forced her to drive to his place. Shannon asked, "What are you doing?" And he replied, "Don't argue, just drive." Once he got her to his house, he tied Shannon up in a guest room. He convinced her that he just wanted to steal her car and that he would release her when he sold it. Hinton said throughout this whole thing, he would sometimes leave Shannon tied up, then go downstairs to make phone calls in order to establish an alibi. He called his wife, relatives, and friends. Leaving Shannon tied up, Hinton went back to the club, found Shannon's car, and drove it to the gas station. He left the car unlocked and the keys in the ignition in hopes that someone would steal the car and throw the police off. Hinton said when he got back home, he untied Shannon and raped her. Then he handcuffed her, face down on the floor, to a bedpost. He said he asked her if she wanted anything, like the radio on. He said Shannon said yes, she'd like 97.1 FM, a local rock station. The whole time Shannon was alive, Hinton said she was calm and cooperative. She never lost control of her emotions, even when she was being raped. Hinton said, quote, "She didn't ever try to scratch, no hitting. I kept telling her, as soon as I get your car sold or rid of it, I will let you go. And she said, all right." Then Butch Hinton left to see the Mighty Ducks in theaters with his niece, nephew, and their parents. He got back home around 10:30 p.m. Shannon was still where he left her, He started panicking about what he had done. He said he raped her again, then started asking himself, "What am I going to do?" Then he said he went to bed. Around 3 hours later, at 2 a.m., Hinton said he got up and stood in his bedroom door. He saw Shannon laying on the guest room floor. He said, quote, "I stood there staring, thinking about how I was going to take her life." That's when he saw the tie rack in his room. He grabbed a tie, walked into the guest room, stood there, and stared down at Shannon. He said she had no idea he was standing there. He thought she was asleep. Hinton said, quote, "I came over on top of her real quick. I took the tie and put it around her neck. I think I crossed it and I strangled her right there. She stopped moving. It happened a lot quicker than I ever thought. When it happened that quick, I was so scared. I thought she was unconscious. But then he noticed how Shannon's body grew pale and began to stiffen." For the next hour and a half, Hinton said he was downstairs sitting on his couch and pacing. He eventually decided to move Shannon's body to a rollaway dumpster on the side of his house. Then he put her body on a bed of logs and brush and set it on fire with some gas he had in the garage. When it started raining, Hinton said he was worried the fire would die out, so he went and bought more gas. A wood fire burns at 1,470 to 1,650 degrees Fahrenheit. In a crematorium, the temperatures go from 2,010 to 2,730 degrees Fahrenheit. During the cremation process, all the bones are not burned to ash. The larger fragments are ground up. It takes the average human body 2 to 3 hours to burn completely. So if Butch really did burn her body, he would have had to smash up the pieces of bone that didn't burn. So it's possible that he did burn her body and just put the bone fragments in the trash bag. And of course, he borrowed that bone saw from his father the following morning at 7 a.m. So it's possible there were more than just fragments of Shannon's bones left at that point. His dad said he offered to bring the saw over, but Hinton said no, he'd come get it. When he got back home, he said Shannon's body was completely incinerated. Then, Butch Hinton said he got dressed and went to church. At around 2 p.m., his wife Michelle got home. He said he was worried she would ask what he did that weekend, so he tried to distract her. He took her to Olive Garden for dinner and gave her one of the two rings he had stolen off Shannon's fingers. The other was the blue topaz ring, later found in the phone booth. At around 11 p.m. that night, Hinton was worried that the police were on their way to his house any minute. So he got up and cleaned the ashes from the fire. He told Michelle that they had to clean up the yard before a landscaper came over the next day. Michelle held the bag as he dumped the ashes in. She had no idea the ashes were from a body. Then Hinton said he took the bag of ashes to a ditch near some railroad tracks and wrecks and dumped them. During his confession, Hinton insisted that his house fire was an accident. He didn't start it. It's weird how he would confess to all the details of Shannon's rape and murder, but deny the arson he was convicted of. After finding out what Hinton confessed to, Shannon's father, Luis, told ABC News, quote, "He is a more professional criminal than the police are professional policemen. He killed her and burned her body in the backyard. The police were out there and they could not find a trace of my daughter. I don't believe that." But it had been 18 days before police searched Butch Hinton's house. Maybe if they had taken Shannon's disappearance seriously and questioned her co-workers right away, they might have found evidence in his house. But no, he had 2.5 weeks to destroy evidence, not to mention the weather. Rain could have washed away much of the evidence from any fire outside of his house. Lead prosecutor John Petrie said he didn't understand why Hinton was given such a lenient sentence for what he did to the 14-year-old girl in 1982. It was clear that Hinton should be kept in prison. He would most likely only escalate. Petrie said, quote, "His ferociousness, his sexual appetite, it should have been apparent that this was not just a young man who slipped up. He was building up for bigger things." Yes, exactly. Butch Hinton had a terrifying pattern that had definitely escalated. culminating in the rape and murder of 19-year-old Shannon Melendi. It wasn't just the DeKalb police who screwed up. It was also the judge who gave him the light sentence for Tammy's rape, the parole board that let him out after 2 years, the juvenile judge who only sentenced a 17-year-old rapist to counseling. It was the whole system that led to a monster like Butch Hinton being free to murder Shannon Melendi, a system that did not take the assault of young women seriously. In so many ways, and in almost 30 years since Shannon's murder, it hasn't really gotten much better. According to the Justice Department and RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, less than 1% of sexual assaults ever lead to a conviction. Women are afraid to come forward. They know what they're in for. They know their lives will be torn apart. They are afraid they won't be believed. So only about 23% of victims even report the crime. And of those who report, only about 20% actually make it to trial. The Dallas Morning News wrote about this problem in 2019. Quote, "The National Sexual Violence Resource Center warns prosecutors that juries are unlikely to believe victims who don't describe what they see as real rape. In a real rape, the victim and the rapist are strangers. The rapist uses a weapon, and there are wounds to prove it. The victim fights back, and she is completely sober at the time. She cries when she tells police what happened. This real rape bears little resemblance to the reality of most rapes. Victims rarely fight back. They freeze up. Most know their assailants. Many victims go into survival mode and seem emotionless when they recount their experiences." End quote. Does that sound familiar? All of Butch Hinton's victims knew him. They all complied and did not fight back. And most importantly, all of them except the family member did report Hinton, only to have prosecutors give him lenient deals and judges give him the lightest sentences. 14-year-old Tammy was brave enough to go to court, and then her rapist took a deal and only got 4 years. And when he got out after serving 2 years, he escalated to murder. At least she did get to face him again in the trial for Shannon's murder and help put him away. It's sickening. The statistics say 1 in 5 women will be raped in her lifetime. Think about it. That could be you, your best friend, your mother, your sister, your daughter. We have got to find a way to do better. Experts aren't really sure how to fix our justice system, but they all agree that education is the first step. We have to talk about it. We also need more trauma-trained investigators. We need to build trust with victims. We need to change our own perspectives and biases. Jurors bring their own personal preconceived notions to trial. And we really need prosecutors and judges to adjudicate sex crimes more seriously. Stop giving deals and light sentences to predators who will only escalate if we don't hold them responsible. In 1995, a large section of Southwest 48th Street in Miami was renamed Shannon Melendi Drive. This is in the neighborhood where she was raised and went to high school. Today, Butch Hinton is incarcerated in Hays State Prison in Chattooga County, Georgia. In 2012, Hinton became eligible for parole for the first time. He was denied. He became eligible again in 2020, which forced Shannon's family and friends to go before the board again and fight for Hinton to stay in prison. His parole was denied again. However, by law, Hinton will be eligible to apply for parole every 7 to 8 years. Yvonne said in 2020, quote, "At least we can breathe, and we'll be able to breathe for another 7 or 8 years. Luis said, "I'm still very angry. I don't want him coming out. I don't want him hurting anyone. Shannon is dead forever, and he should be in prison forever. And I'm going to be extremely angry if they parole him. Shannon is already dead. But if they let him out and he kills someone else, it is on them, not us." Yvonne said the next time he's eligible, they will be in their 80s. Luis added, "If this continues to come up, at some point we will be dead. And then what I left Monique, what we left Monique, is to deal with this animal, to deal with this situation, and I don't want her to inherit that from us. Sadly, Yvonne Melendi passed away on May 19, 2021 from COVID. Yvonne had said about Hinton's parole hearings in 2020, quote, "You build up scar tissue over the years. You have to relive it. It's tough. It's very tough. He does have a sliver of hope. He shouldn't have any hope at all." Louise said, "He's killed not only Shannon, he's killed my family. This man destroyed my parents, Yvonne's mom, the rest of the family. They've never been the same. And the worst is Monique. That's who he hurt the most." Monique said, quote, "I refuse to believe her death was in vain. I feel that he's done this before. I think this is just the first time he's been caught for murder. And I think it took us catching him, for Shannon, to prevent him from doing this to another family, to other women. It's a huge weight on us. In my heart, I don't believe he'll get out. But I have to continue fighting to make sure that doesn't happen." I agree with Monique that Butch Hinton had murdered before. The collection of partially burned women's clothes buried in his yard is very suspicious and has never been explained. Why did he make that phone call to Emery on April 6th, giving investigators the evidence to put him away with Shannon's ring? Was he trying to throw them off? I think it's likely he's a sadist who was enjoying watching her family's pain in the press. And why did he confess to Shannon's murder? Many people, including me, think it was for the parole board. Hinton was smart enough to supposedly show remorse almost immediately. That matters. And it may have been a calculated move on his part. In 2019, the Georgia Parole Board granted parole to 10% of the lifers who were eligible that year. It was 188 inmates. To make a decision on parole, the board members do not hold hearings. They will each review Hinton's case file, including the letters and petitions opposing parole for Hinton, and then each member will cast a vote. The Melendis have a change.org petition you can sign that will be given to the parole board. I'll have the link in my show notes as well as the information to write to the board. I really hope Luis outlives Hinton, but he's right. Hinton is only 61 years old right now. And I am so glad that Monique is such a warrior. She is only about 40 years old now. "I was 5 days shy of my 14th birthday when she was murdered," Monique said. She told the Emory Will in 2020, quote, "This is our life sentence, having to continue to fight to keep him in there." She said, "It has completely destroyed our family. This isn't something you just get over and move on with your life." It changed her. She learned from an early age to fight for justice with her family. They never gave up, and they're not giving up now. And because that monster destroyed her body, her family was not even able to say goodbye. People say there really is no closure, that you just get used to the pain. But there is some measure of closure in burying your child. I cannot imagine never seeing mine again. At the time of her March 1994 disappearance, Shannon Melendi's favorite song was Forever Young by Alphaville. Some are like water, some are like the heat, some are a melody, and some are the beat. Do you really want to live forever? Forever and ever. Shannon is forever young, forever beautiful, forever the girl who dreamed so big. A bright light who was cruelly snuffed out. Southern Fried True Crime is written, hosted, and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched by the one and only Haley Gray, with additional research by me. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic artist by Coley Horner. Please sign the change.org petition I've put into today's show notes, or write the parole board for the Melendi family. Shannon's killer should never be let out of prison. He is a sexual predator of the worst kind. Monique will continue to fight, but our voices can really help. Please submit case suggestions to southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept suggestions on social media, and I apologize if I am unable to answer your your email. I get dozens of suggestions a week, and it takes time to go through and check out each case. I will definitely contact you if I plan to use the case you submit to see if you would like to be credited on the episode. Thank you all so much for sending in these suggestions. I truly get my most interesting cases from listener suggestions, so keep them coming. Don't forget to come find our new Facebook group. Search for Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group. We still worship our patron saint, Dolly Parton, share fun memes, and delicious recipes. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit asses allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe, and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I am also on most large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.